So we are in Berkeley. We're actually at the Hotel Durant, just off the Berkeley campus, and we're visiting with Matthew, or Matt Walker, who's a neuroscientist here at UC Berkeley, and technically, I suppose, runs the Sleep and Neuroimaging Laboratory there as
well. That's correct.
You've got some really great, interesting papers that I'd like to get into, some of the work you've been doing recently, but let me just go back to this nice review article you did, The Year in Cognitive Neuroscience, at the end of 2009, for the Annals of the New York Academy of Sciences. It begins, "A perplexing question continues to elude scientific judgment. Why do we sleep?" Why?
Well, the answer is probably multifactorial, in the sense that we don't sleep for one specific reason. And that may have been one of the root causes why we've failed to come to some consensus, is that we've been searching for that one singular holy grail of the function of sleep. But for me, that's never made very much sense. Take, for example, the time that you're awake. We spend two-thirds of our life awake. And we're awake not just to achieve one function. We achieve many different functions when we're awake. And I couldn't imagine the same type of logic would be applied to that additional one-third of our life that we spend sleeping. So I think the question really is, what are the functions, plural, that sleep serves rather than singular? And we're starting to find that it serves functions both for brain and also for body. So I think it's a slightly misplaced question to look for that singular function. It may be that one particular function has driven sleep through the evolutionary process, and it's survived across phylogeny in a very powerful way, which must tell us that it's important at the very most fundamental of biological levels. But now, certainly at the human level, I think we should be asking, what are the functions rather than function?
Okay, well, let's look at some of the answers that have come up in, when I've asked that question to lots of the other people, the sleep researchers who I've spoken to on the Science Network. Most of them are in the sort of restorative neck of the woods, pruning something or other, resetting overstimulated synapses, clearing out unwanted garbage, that going back to Crick and Mitchison and so on. Mm-hmm. Do you have any favorites?
Yeah, I mean, sleep has no shortage of possible gambles that you can bet on. I think from the perspective of sleep saving you some degree of energy expenditure, which was a sort of an old somewhat theory. In other words, we sleep to rest. That makes very little sense, because it turns out that for humans, for example, the caloric savings that you get by going to sleep versus lying still for that same duration of time but remaining conscious is minuscule. It's about the caloric savings of a slice of brown bread. So that makes no sense to me. That, I mean, you would just go out and, you know, club another animal and digest it and save the, you know, get over that caloric need, and not fall prey to that remarkably disastrous, in one concept, notion of leaving consciousness, leaving the outside world, going into a state where you're desperately vulnerable. You're not also interacting, you're not seeking out mates, you're not eating anymore. So the concept of sleep from a biological perspective is quite strange when you think about it in terms of its vulnerability, and that it would just save you that small amount of caloric value versus remaining awake and hence vigilant to potential threat. I don't think that really makes very much sense to us. I think the concept that sleep may afford some neurophysiological brain state that optimally balances the acquisition of information during the day, either strengthening information or perhaps erasing information, or probably doing both, which is what I suspect and what we're starting to find is the case. I think that makes a lot more sense. That can have a metabolic benefit to it, of course. But that sleep is there to simply just allow us to rest and not continue to burn calories, I don't think holds any weight for me, just from a pure sort of mathematical value.
And I think you'd find support there from somebody like Jerry Siegel, who is often seen as an outlier in the field, but makes some, I think, delivered a very interesting review paper last year, as you know, on looking across across the various species and seeing what was exactly was going on, and it sort of underpins what you've just been saying, that doesn't seem to be a premium on for an evolutionary argument for doing that at all. So,
yeah.
Now in terms of the useful function of the restorative tasks that you're talking about there, or the pruning and the synthesizing, storing of information. Could you speak to some of the work you've been doing specifically about memory then? Because that fits into that part of the picture.
Yeah. So really we've been finding that sleep may assist or support three critical aspects of memory. The first is that sleep after learning seems to be important in a process that we call consolidation. And that's in some way the act of the brain cementing or solidifying the new information that you learned during the day, and hence preventing it from being forgotten or lost. In addition, we've been finding that it's not just sleep after learning that's important, but also sleep before learning seems to be critically important in a sense of preparing the brain, almost, I suppose, like a dry sponge ready to soak up new information the next day. And so it's sleep on both sides of the coin that seems to be important. But I think one of the new findings that we're beginning to discover here is that sleep may go beyond simply strengthening individual memories, but sleep may actually be able to intelligently integrate and synthetically associate new memories together. And the reason that I find that exciting is because when you start to put information together in ways that perhaps it normally doesn't go together, at least in our waking cognition, that may afford you the creative insights for next day novel ideas. It starts to sound very much like the basis of biological creativity. Mm-hmm. And so I think we're starting to now find that sleep has this quite permissive role in all of these different stages of memory, getting you ready the next day to soak up new information. Once you've taken on board that information, the following night sleep is going to solidify and cement that information. But then also, and this may take multiple nights rather than one single night, sleep may have some kind of an algorithm of information processing that starts to try and determine which memories should be associated together. Because we know for a fact that memories do not sit as an isolate island in your brain. I mean, that would be profoundly unuseful. But, and in fact, it's quite like a computer. That's why computers, in some ways, are so unintelligent, that they have all of this information, but in some way, it doesn't seem to be synthetically related or integrated. So we know that the brain, instead, with its information, doesn't sort of float it like islands disconnected, but your memories are richly interconnected in these webs of association. And neuroscience has not really had a good understanding as to how and when or even why the brain builds those connections and those associations. And now we're starting to find evidence that one of the brain states that may support that type of intelligent creative association is sleep.
One of the interesting things, that as you were describing that, I was thinking about the beginnings of the World Wide Web. And I was thinking about the precursor, which was a number of essays written by Vannevar Bush, immediately pre and post-war. Bush was a science advisor, and he was an engineer, and he came up with a system called Memex. And he was actually thinking about different kinds of files. He was thinking about microfiches and so on and so forth. Mm. But he imagined a room, maybe even something as small as desk-sized, that had this enormous store of all these things. And the important thing that he was talking about was that they were connected by what the phrase he used, I find particularly compelling, knowing the neuroscience of networks in these days. He called them associative trails. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that that's a pretty exact evocative description of the way you build up adaptive representational networks in brain and memory and so on. So the sense of walking around with your own sort of World Wide Web here that's because of the neuroplasticity constantly updating. Mm-hmm. That's a kind of picture that you would sign on to?
Yeah, I think it is. I'm not trying to suggest that the only time that we build those associative connections is when we're asleep. I think it's quite obvious that experience whilst we're awake allows us to compute and identify those connections. I think what we are finding, though, is that perhaps the more distant, the more non-obvious connections, those may be things that sleep may be best able to afford. And there's a variety of neurobiological foundations as to why that may be the case. But it's strange that in sleep research, we are commonly reinforcing probably what your mother told you and what all of those cliches tell you. I mean, a good example would be, or when was the last time someone told you to stay awake on a problem? Nobody tells you that.
Right.
Now that's simply just hand-waving and a little hyperbole, but I think now what we're starting to get into is an understanding empirically that sleep can afford that type of building, not perhaps of the most obvious connections, those that you see when you're awake, but perhaps the more distant ones that are much more difficult in a logical, analogical way of thinking to actually identify and seek out. Perhaps sleep is much more divergent in its algorithm of information processing rather than convergent.
So sometimes headline writers get these things right. There's a piece that Poe Bronson did, which you'll recall in New York Magazine, where you talk about some of your work there, and the headline was Snooze or Lose, which for once is not a bad, description of what's going on here. In terms of how this fits into, translates into real life, I mean, we're looking at a picture here of a kid about to go to school and so on. I mean, when you think about what most children are doing most days, it's going and learning, it's going and acquiring new information, mm-hmm. building new networks of associations of information. That's what they're supposed to do. That's what education is, to a large extent, right? So what's the interrelationship between what you know from the neuroscience you've been doing and your colleagues and how that's translated and implemented in classroom, to take one example?
Yeah, I think the blunt answer is that it's not. And I think there's probably a number of reasons for that, both practical and also translational in terms of conveying that information out to policymakers, that it has an impact and that it should have an impact. I think that I'm of no doubt. I think some of that view of sleep and its importance is modified by how little we value it as a society. And in fact, it's remarkably strange when you think about it. I mean, society right now is almost proud of how little sleep that it gets. I mean, people will almost sort of brag sometimes about how little sleep that they're getting, as if it's a badge to wear on your arm of honor. And I find that very strange. People on the sort of flip side of that additionally almost feel embarrassed when they tell you that they get 8 hours of sleep. I mean, if you ask them, you know, how many hours of sleep do you get? And they say, well, eight and a half hours of sleep. Really? now that surprises me. And you laugh because, you know, the irony may be starting to sort of, you know, unfold here. And I think the reason, and it's a big problem, is that we've started to equate sufficient sleep, and I use that word very deliberately, sufficient sleep with laziness. And that should not be the case. We know that sleep in terms of just innate essentiality is as important as something like food. In fact, rats will die as quickly of food deprivation as they will sleep deprivation. So my point being is that at some point we have to start casting off that old notion of sleep being a luxury that we choose or choose not to engage in, and realize that it's absolutely necessary. What's strange, however, is that we don't always have that opinion, because you would never look, or people don't look at an infant sleeping during the day and think, What a lazy infant. We don't do that because we realize that sleep is critically important at that early developmental age. But somewhere between that early developmental period and adulthood, we seem to let go of the notion of sleep being important.
Well, there's an extra step here, which you very eloquently described earlier, which makes all the difference if people more generally knew this, which is if they equate the state of being asleep with being a state in which you're restoring depleted energy resources, which is the thing that we dumped at the very beginning, if you recall, then if you're doing that to excess, then you obviously appear to be lazy.
Right.
Now, if the explanation is put in there that no, it's not for that. It's so that your brain will function simply better in with an optimized performance because it has the capacity then to build and restore networks of memory and so on and so forth, then that becomes, I would have thought, a positive thing that you could sell to people. Oh, okay, I'll go and sleep then.
Right. So. And I think it's an understandable misconception that sleep perhaps does not offer this plethora of benefit, because for the most part, when we wake up from sleep, we feel that our mind and our body has mostly been dormant. Yes, we may have these fleeting experiences that we call dreams, but it doesn't feel like this rigorous 8-hour workout at a mental level. And so we think, well, since it's not doing much, then presumably I can shortchange it and not suffer too much. And so I think it's completely understandable, and I don't mean to be derogatory of that opinion. It's just that it's simply wrong. Yeah. And I think now we've got the science to back it up, and I think nowhere perhaps is that more important than in the educational realm. I think if our role as educators is to allow the brain to absorb as much potential useful information to develop the best individuals for society, then I think sleep has to be a factor that is essential in them. We are very good at thinking about things such as diet. We've become especially, aware of that in recent times. We've long known about the benefits of things like exercise. But the domain that's out there in the cold is really sleep. Mm-hmm. And it's right up there in terms of those, four primary functions of living organisms, eating, drinking, procreating, and sleeping.
Yeah.
Sleep is out there, and we need to bring it in.
Yes, I would have thought you'd need to be alert to learn something. I don't know if is that wrong?
No. It's a very obvious assumption, but it seems to be one that also is not reflected in terms of perhaps an educational structure. Just take, for example, the times of start for classes. Now, these times are applied, and again, for understandable reasons, across a broad array of age ranges. Now, for some of those age ranges, that time may be optimal. So, for example, in younger children who have a biological rhythm, that is, going to bed early and waking up early, that may be a permissive time for learning and acquisition of new information. In later childhood and into adolescence, biological rhythms shift dramatically. And anyone with a teenage son or daughter knows this very well. It's wanting to stay up late and wake up late. Now, there, the school time is completely oppositional to that biological shift. And that biological shift is very resistant in the sense of it being unadaptable or inflexible. And people, I think, particularly parents, may have a harder time in trying to understand why teenagers, for example, can't just get up and go at 6 o'clock in the morning. Why are they seemingly just, staring out the window? Why do they look inattentive in the first period of class? It's not necessarily that they're going through some hormonal angst in addition. But I suspect that a good amount of that is simply because they were woken up at a time that's far from optimal for their brain capacity for things like learning. And I don't think it's surprising that when you shift school times, which several states have done now, you find that in those later age ranges, grade point averages will increase. So I think there's evidence both from a scientific perspective and now in a real life applied perspective that that type of shift may make a difference. And maybe we should think about that more seriously.
Now, do you know, happen to know in the states that have done that, I mean, what sort of social upheaval that created? Because I can imagine, I mean, the obvious answer to what you were saying is, well, fine, the science sounds great, but do you know what you're saying here? I mean, with all those fleets of minivans out there will have to be rescheduled, and the school buses, and everything has to then be built around shifting circadian rhythms.
Right.
Good heavens.
No, and I don't mean to suggest that it's an easy task or it comes with an easy solution. Right. And I think many of these structures are in place for particular reasons, and transportation is probably one of them. It would be, you know, somewhat inefficient to take your younger children to school at one time in the morning and then wait an hour or 2 hours and then take your older children again to school, and then, you know, later in the afternoon you pick up your younger children first and then you come back and then you go and pick up your older children. You know, I think that that's a difficult thing that we have to think about. But if we just roll that back, if we try and step back from the pragmatics and simply ask, what is the purpose of school? What is the purpose of education? And if the purpose of education is efficient learning, then currently we seem to have a system that is designed for non-optimal learning. You know, we're very smart, bright creatures, and I think there's ways that we can think about how to find a better solution. And I think scientists and educators should perhaps get together and think about those, and policymakers in addition. But I also think that idea of sleep being promoted more substantially to children and teenagers will have a whole host of additional benefits beyond things like learning and memory, particularly for mental health. I think that's where we're also starting to see sleep have some functionality in the domain of emotional regulation of the brain.
Yes, emotionally I want to get it, because I actually have a Scientific American piece here, which again is talking about some work of yours, and I think Bob is quoted as well, Bob Stickgold. Headline again, just to get into this, is, can a lack of sleep cause psychiatric disorders? So the relationship between sleep and emotions.
Yeah, I mean, so it's something that's, you know, long been speculated on. If you look back at the work of someone like Freud, you know, there are crumbs of it there. But I think now we're starting to come to a much more neuroscientifically reasoned viewpoint of that possible theory. It's an interesting one where basic science seems to be lagging behind the clinical science. Often some of the basic science is very informative to help clinical neuroscience advance. But here, the clinical neuroscience domain is actually quite ahead of the basic science progression. And what I mean by that is we've known for a long time now that almost all psychiatric mood disorders, things like depression, things like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, they all co-occur with sleep abnormalities and sleep disruption. In fact, I've yet to be able to go through the DSM-IV, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, and find a mood disorder that does not have a co-occurring sleep disruption with it. And I think for some time we've been thinking that those two entities are simply co-occurring. But I think more recently we're beginning to perhaps shift and believe that they may actually be causally related. I think it's unlikely that it's a unidirectional relationship. If that unidirectional mentality has been in place before, it's usually been perhaps in the direction that it's the psychiatric disorder that is causing the sleep abnormality rather than vice versa. I don't think such complex situations are ever unidirectional. I think they're most likely bidirectional. But I think an important question is, what's the dominant flow of traffic down that two-way street? And I think now we're starting to find that in healthy people, if you disrupt their sleep or deprive them of sleep, they have behavioral expressions and they also have neural signatures that look not dissimilar to those that we know in certain psychiatric mood disorders. So I think we're starting to build this emerging picture that sleep beyond things like learning and memory is critical for the optimal homeostasis of your mood and your affective regulation.
Okay, let me ask you a couple of questions on this. I'm looking at this cerebral cortex paper, a role for REM sleep in recalibrating the sensitivity of the human brain to specific emotions.
Yeah.
which is where you're navigating at this point. Do you want to just speak a little bit more to that? Or?
Yeah, so it's one piece of evidence that I think is starting to build now that if there is a stage of sleep that appears to be emerging that may support this homeostasis, this refreshing of our emotional reactivity, it may be REM sleep. And REM sleep has a number of biological features that we could speak about that seem optimal for that job. But more generally, I think what we're finding is that, for example, REM sleep can reset the reactivity of the brain to unique and specific types of emotions. REM sleep seems to perhaps depotentiate or ameliorate your reactivity to negative or threat-relevant, aversive emotions, and actually enhance your sensitivity and reception towards positive, rewarding emotions. Mm-hmm. So sleep may have this ability to sort of reset the magnetic north of the emotional compass across those domains. And that's presumably a critically important role too. I think we all have that sense that when we haven't slept the night before, our emotional stability is not quite what it is when we've had a good night of sleep. Infants are a good example. I think we've all had that experience of a parent holding a young child and the child is crying and they look at you and they just say, well, he just didn't sleep well last night. As if there's some universal knowledge that bad sleep the night before equals bad mood regulation the next day. And I think now we're starting to find exactly what happens when you don't sleep, the dynamics of the brain and how certain regions such as the prefrontal cortex lose their ability to connect to what we would think of as the more reptilian sort of Neanderthal, we call limbic brain regions, the emotional centers of the brain. And that connection, we believe, is normally present to help us regulate our emotions. But without sleep, by severing that critically important connection, we may sort of be all gas pedal and no brake, as it were, in terms of our emotions, all limbic system and particularly the amygdala, and no frontal control regulating that need to react. So I think there's growing evidence that without sleep, the brain networks that are normally supporting optimal emotional regulation become disrupted, and also we're starting to find what particular type of sleep may be regulating that type of emotional refresh, as it were.
And you talked about homeostasis being the sort of optimal state that the brain sort of tends to work in, or the entire system. I was talking to Lauren Frank this morning and have spoken to other people as well about the notion of allostasis, where you've effectively cranked the system up a little bit, and we're questioning whether in those heightened states of receptivity and attention, where reward plays an enormous part as well, where you've got dopamine at work and so on, that perhaps you could be in addicted to learning, in quotes there, that the heightened ability to learn, and that you get into those kind of states where you can acquire information more effectively, sort of kicked out of that homeostatic equilibrium. And the question would be how long you could maintain that, and how you refresh that when you get to a point where that's becoming producing, glucocorticoids or stress and so on. Do you think about those sorts of areas as well?
I think, one idea is how far, in terms of sleep and sleep loss, how far can the band stretch before it snaps in some way? How far into that allostatic load could you go without sufficient sleep before you truly get decrement? And I think people have been finding, in a worrying sense, in terms of animal models, that some of the deficits that you get by just one night of acute sleep deprivation are not restored even after several nights of recovery sleep. Mm-hmm. And so I think what that tells us is that there is a reason that after about, in humans, 16 hours, we start to feel quite a strong desire to go to sleep. And that progressively builds the longer into that night of pulling the all-nighter that we go. So I think in terms of the biological system for sleep sensitivity to loss, my sense is that band doesn't stretch very far. before detrimental consequences happen. Now, I spoke about some of those deficits that you get caused by sleep, you becoming hyper-emotional in terms of in response to negative experiences and events. One other plausible possibility, however, is that that is the optimal state to be in when you have not had sleep. I don't think it's a state that is useful to maintain, and this gets back to that idea of sort of allostatic load and how the system tries to respond and how long the system can respond under those conditions. You know, it could be that when you have not slept and your vigilance and your attention and your alertness is low, perhaps what you don't want to be is in that sort of cognitive, you know, sort of deliberating domain where you can regulate emotions, you can think about the consequences and the social ramifications. Perhaps the best thing to do when you haven't slept is be in that instantly reactive state where you go back to almost Neanderthal-like traits. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason why the brain goes into that state. So you can offer different interpretations of these results. One is that it's detrimental. One is that perhaps it's simply the brain trying to adapt to its currently sleep-deprived state.
So the decision making that is made in these deprived states. I'm just picked up an article from the current issue of Sleep, the Journal of Sleep and Sleep Disorders Research, and this is a piece from the Naval Academy in Norway. The impact of partial sleep deprivation on moral reasoning in military officers. I haven't read it in elaborate detail, so I haven't. But this is the kind of topic area that does come up. They haven't had enough sleep. They're working with possible, doing interrogations or whatever. Are they in an optimal moral state? So these things extend right across the board here, and the importance of sleep is just enormously far-ranging. It's not just the truck drivers driving off the freeway and so on that I've talked to Dave Dingers and Chuck Seisler about and so on. Here now we're talking about moral reasoning in military officers. And we do know that, of course, substances like Provigil have been used by the military for keeping heightened, extended periods of alertness.
Right.
So the swings and roundabouts thing starts to become very large here, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you start to then ask in terms of, you know, we can speak about the science, but what is the applicability? And is that at all concerning? And I think the answer is yes, it is concerning, because when you think about some of the professions where sleep deprivation is somewhat rampant, I mean, if you think about things like military, if you think about aviation, if you think about law enforcement, if you think about medicine, you know, these are all situations where you would like the individual to have optimal rational and emotional thinking. And to also be able to recollect information and perhaps make judgments based on prior experience. These are all circumstances where we know a state of sleep deprivation can impair such optimal functioning. And so I think that type of, you know, even in new parenting, I mean, it's an interesting phenomenon by itself, where you would imagine that the ability to recognize emotions in others, to, you know, empathize, to have that sort of that concept of theory of mind, being able to understand how individuals, other individuals beyond yourself, are thinking and rationing and reasoning, feeling. These are all things that you could imagine, based on the data, are being impaired by sleep deprivation. And maybe there's another policy issue that we want to think about in those particular professions. I mean, when I go into, or if I go into the emergency ward at, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning with an appendicitis, you know, I would hope that the staff and the doctors have some empathetic sense of the emotional experience I'm going through. It's critical for their judgment and decision making.
Was this always on the cards for you? I mean, how did you get into this line of work in the first place? I mean, why science? Background, family, teacher, a book you read?
Yeah, so Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, for sleep in particular, I should say, I don't think anyone ever sets out to be a sleep researcher. There are no deliberate...
I'm going to be a sleep researcher.
Right, you know, I mean, it's not that same thing that, you know, children, when you ask them, or, you know, teenagers, you know, what would you like to be, you know, astronaut, you know, policeman, you know. Nobody says sleep research, you know, so we're a very strange ilk. But myself, generally, I mean, I was always inquisitive. I think I was always much more interested in questions than I was answers. My grandfather was, I think, very much a closet scientist. He would write essays just on sort of ideas of sort of philosophical but also mechanical engineering based. He was very scientifically minded in that sense, which I think had a big influence on me. But I think I just drifted into the, just because of that affinity for question. And probably the reason that, for example, I didn't necessarily go into medicine. You know, medicine, I think, is principally concerned with answers, and quite rightly so. Again, I want someone to know what to do when my appendices, you know, burst. But I think what I would, in terms of looking back, believe that transition happened is really just a love of questioning and trying to then dream up how you go about testing those questions. I'm much more interested in that. I think the other thing that was influential was next door, when I was probably 11 or 12 years old, a family moved in, and they had a very young daughter who had, eventually it was diagnosed, Asperger's syndrome. Mm. And it always struck me, because everyone, including myself around me, very quickly understood that her behavior was not necessarily normal. And in fact, we're all amazing psychologists in that sense. We're very attuned to non-normal behavior. You see it in people in the street who are intoxicated through whatever reasons, or who are mentally not well. We very quickly pick up on all of these complex behaviors and understand at least something's amiss. And what I was shocked to find out or understand is that there was not some brain scan that they could have done that would reveal this, you know, enormous issue inside the brain, you know, some hole where a piece of the brain should be but it wasn't, or some, you know, enlarged area that should not be enlarged. You know, but I was starting to learn that, you know, it was fiendishly difficult for them to, you know, find out and pinpoint what was wrong. And the reason that that was a surprise was because the behavior was so overtly abnormal, but yet everything biological seemed to be so normal. Yeah. And that, to me, was, I mean, you couldn't ask for a more fascinating question, the question of the brain and how it functions and how it becomes dysfunctional. So I think that was another influential
sort of trajectory. So where did you grow up?
So I grew up, I was in Liverpool for the first 11 years of my life, then moved to a town outside of there called Chester. And then with education all over England, and then I went to do a postdoctoral position at Boston with a sleep researcher called Alan Hobson. And
so there's a perfect lineage here, of course, for the great Alan Hobson, Bob Stickgold, working with Alan as well. And
that's where I met Bob Stickgold. We were both in Alan Hobson's
lab.
Then
you ended up writing papers with Bob.
And so we just hit it off very well, yeah. He became a surrogate mentor and did a lot of fun work together.
But what about sleep research in the UK?
So I think sleep
research, it doesn't seem to be quite as vigorous and active a field somehow. I mean, I know Loughborough and so on, but hard to think of a lot of equivalent. I mean, it's a really major industry here.
It is, yeah. And so I think there's certainly two reasons for that. So I think sleep research back in the UK is perhaps a little bit anemic. I think there are already two principal groups.
I was going to say dormant, but I mean, that's...
There's now a nice group that's emerged at Surrey, led by Dirk-Jan Dyke, who was at Harvard, is doing a lot of nice basic research work. But the way the healthcare system is set up back in England, it doesn't necessarily promote awareness or perhaps money-making around sleep clinics in a way that it does over here with a privatized medicine system in the United States. And I think that has been one of the factors that that's driven the dominance of sleep research over in the US. But that perhaps doesn't explain why there is this prolific amount of basic research, which doesn't necessarily need to be driven by a medical domain or a clinical domain, but yet is here. So I think it's one of those interesting, puzzling question marks, and perhaps one of the reasons that I ended up transplanting over to the US to do this kind of work.
So did you ever think about doing anything else? I mean, are you not a frustrated frontman for a rock band or something?
I wish I had that type of aspiring, I think the other thing I do love is the concepts of design and architecture, that's got some family roots in it. But I think for better or worse, I'm a scientist.
I'm a scientist, yeah. One of the questions I like to ask people is about the relationship between science and society, and I usually frame that around President Obama. When he came in, his inaugural, he said that his administration would restore science to its rightful place. So what do you think is the rightful place of science? I'm just thinking some of the programs that we, some of the subject areas that we talk about, as I've said to you, are very much interlinked. In other words, the diet, nutrition, metabolism, aging, sleep, education. Let's just look at aging for a minute, because I didn't speak to you about that so far. The aging brain, vast increasing population now, of course. Anything special? Any commentary there about sleep patterns and aging? And the reason I ask this is that in terms of cognition and the kind of cognitive tasks that older people should perhaps be setting themselves to maintain levels of awareness and alertness and so on, are very similar to the ones that you'd actually want to employ in schools as well.
Right.
Optimizing brain is optimizing brain, no matter. But are there certain things that we need to know about the aging brain and sleep, for example?
Yeah, so we currently have a large program grant to look at the relationship between sleep, aging, and memory. To me, the link really came by way of thinking one of the cognitive hallmarks of aging that we, of course, we're all aware of is that your ability to learn and retain information starts to deteriorate. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is that one of the physiological hallmarks of aging is sleep deterioration. We know that the deep, what we call slow wave sleep, it's a part of a broader stage of sleep called non-rapid eye movement sleep or non-REM sleep. That deep slow wave sleep starts to decrease quite perniciously at a quite early age. So somewhere in your late 20s, that sleep starts to reduce in its total amount. It becomes very difficult to identify in people who are 60, 70, 80 years old. In other words, it seems to be absent according to its classically scored criteria. It may be present in other ways that we can measure, but certainly I think it's very clear that that particular type of sleep, more so than other types of sleep, becomes significantly, I use the word impaired because I think it's a consequence of the aging pathology. What's interesting is that much of the work that we know regarding the role of sleep in memory and how sleep supports these memory and plasticity functions have identified that it's exactly that particular type of sleep that is critical. And so when you start to put these two things together, the knowledge of sleep supporting learning and memory, the knowledge of sleep deteriorating in aging, the idea of memory deteriorating in aging, they start to tell a quite suggestive story. Those same sleep impairments are amplified in conditions such as dementia. Now, I'm not going to sit here and suggest to you that aging is simply a sleep disorder. Right. It's not. Aging is a multifactorial problem. That sleep could be one of the perhaps less well-characterized factors contributing to cognitive aging, I think is a very exciting prospect. And for me, it's exciting not just because it's, I think, an applied concept in the work that, that people like myself do, but because in many of the other factors that we believe contribute to aging, things like deterioration of gray matter, alteration of white matter fiber tracts in the brain, changes in the vascularization of certain parts of the brain, those are all fiendishly difficult things to treat. In fact, we have very poor ways of currently treating those. Sleep, on the other hand, is a much more treatable potential target. So if it is a new emerging factor that may be contributing to cognitive aging, I think the reason I'm particularly excited about it is because I think it's a possibly more treatable factor, at least currently in terms of science, than these other factors that we know contribute to aging. So I think it's an exciting time for that sleep and aging domain.
All right, so what do you need more of then? You're talking about slow wave, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, speculate. What do you do? You have a little brain monitor. You wear a little nightcap. I suppose the Zio folks and the NeuroVigil folks are already doing this. But that in theory, identifies when you're in slow wave sleep and somehow reinforces that so that you extend it. Do you have enough left for there to be any to reinforce when you get to a certain age? I mean, is there always some slow wave sleep?
Well, so if you use other types of methods to score this or to assess this type of deep slow wave sleep, there seems to be a presence of it there in aging. But whichever way you score it, it's significantly down on younger adults, for example. I think what we would then have to do if we find that that decrease in slow wave sleep across the lifespan is proportional to the decrease in things like learning and memory ability, is then start to invest in understanding how we can increase that type of sleep. We could do it pharmacologically. There are drugs currently out there that we know can enhance that type of deep slow wave sleep. There may be somewhat more invasive methods. For example, you could apply electrical stimulation to parts of the brain to try and amplify the waves of those slow oscillations on the cortex to see if you can restore some functionality. So I think there are a number of interesting potential targets for us to go about restoring that type of sleep. Mm-hmm. I think you could do it perhaps more holistically. There are things like increasing exercise. I think there are changing of sleep habits and behaviors, diet. All of these things could potentially modify the amount of slow wave sleep. I think those latter things may be more difficult because their potency may not be as high as pharmacological or electrical stimulation. But I think that, you know, I think we already have some possibilities out there. We just first need to ethically understand what that relationship is before we go about manipulating the sleep.
Here's something that I like to ask people as well. This is something you can ponder on a sleepless night. If I gave you a time travel token and said that you could invite anybody from history to dinner, multiple people if you like, I mean, are there anybody that, you know, as you were going along your trajectory, you thought, oh God, I wish I could have just sat down and talked to?
I think the potential founder of the field of sleep and memory, who's not given much credit, but I would love to sit down and ask him as to why, was the Roman rhetorician Quintilian, who I believe gave the first explicit definition of the sleep and memory story. And I'm going to paraphrase and probably butcher it horribly, but I believe he said something like, it is a surprising fact that the interval of a night of sleep can assist in the recall of information of things that were not easily recallable at the time, but yet upon awakening are now easy to recollect. And he goes on and continues to speak about this remarkable role of sleep. And I would love to sit down and begin thinking with him about why that emerged. Because at the time, nobody knew anything about the brain at that level. You know, all signs at that time pointed to sleep being about things beyond us, about messages from the gods or, you know, odd states of, you know, demonization. I mean, these were times when scientific thinking about sleep, you know, should not have been present at all. but he had this remarkable, and now, you know, incredibly enlightened insight. I'd love to speak to him.
That's interesting. I thought for a moment there you were going to say Al Rexhaven or Alan Hobson or Bill Dement or something. I was thinking, they're not that old. I mean, come on.
Right, so. Yeah. You probably grabbed dinner with a few.
Good heavens.
Yeah.
That's going back. But that's a very interesting observation. Actually, you go back a number of these things. You find, I was looking back the other day at some of the writings of Francis Bacon, and there's reams of stuff on longevity and some stuff on sleep as well. Yeah. It's very interesting speculations about.
And we should give Freud credit. I mean, he gets a bad rap in our field, and in some ways rightly so, because of course, you know, his concepts of dreams and interpretation of dreams were a non-scientific theory. They weren't provable, and so they don't have, and they have never held that scientific merit. But I think Freud did an amazing service to the field of sleep research, because he placed the concept of sleep and dreaming firmly within the brain. Mm-hmm. When before, as I said, it was really the currency of other things outside of the brain. It was coming from things beyond us, this odd phenomena that we call dreaming. And I think he was the principal reason that sleep science and dream science became a domain of neuroscience of the brain. I mean, after that, things went a little bit south, but but I think, you know, I think he was 50% right and 100% wrong.
Yeah, I know what you mean. All right. You're not exactly an ancient person, but you have been through the mill somewhat, so you could now at a position to do something I like to ask people to do as well, which is to give some advice to a young scientist, as Peter Medawar did in his book. What are your thoughts on that?
I think if you could think of anything other than science to do with your life, and if there's anything that occurs to your brain that you would like to do other than science, go and do it. Because science is nowadays, in this modern era, it's a tough game to be in. It's not purely that idea of waking up in the morning and thinking, okay, what that is currently unknown to mankind would I like to discover today, you know? And I don't know if it ever was that way, but I think, you know, one has to appreciate that there are, you know, enormous degrees of politics. There's the difficulty in getting funding. There's the publish and perish, which is, I think, an odd force that perhaps doesn't necessarily lead to the best quality of science. There's a lot that goes along with being a scientist beyond that simply sort of, you know, bubbling flasks of liquid and measurements and eureka moments. So I think I would sit long and hard. But if you're one of those people who continually asks why, even in the face of authority, and perhaps best in the face of authority, then you should probably give science a try. It's a tough battle, but it's very worth it.
What a great answer. Now, one last thing. What are you optimistic about?
I think I'm continually optimistic about the resilience of human nature. When you open a newspaper, or what I should really say is when you open up your computer in the morning and read the news nowadays, you would be led to believe that we're living in a world of largely negatives, that human beings are desperately unkind to each other. And we are, to some degree, but we're also capable of amazing things. And our resilience to bounce back, even in the face of those negative domains, I think is remarkable. And for that, I think I'm immensely grateful for and enthused by. And also just the sheer creativity of the human mind. And I'm gifted with the option to see it on a daily basis by teaching, you know, young undergraduates and graduate students. I mean, they're amazing, coming up with ideas that, you know, I'm trying to note in the back of my head for subsequent grant submissions. It's wonderful. But I think just in general, I think the resilience of human nature and its general direction towards a positive bent, in a way that I don't think that message comes across through the news, sadly, is something that we should all hold on to. And we all know it innately. I hope it doesn't leave us.
Matt Walker, thanks very much.
Thank you.